the account of history is the theory of the present. How did we get here, and what tasks remain from the past that appear to be, however, new today? Welcome to the Zero Books podcast on the history of the American left. I'm your host, Matt Capograti, and I feel like I should be introducing a David Attenborough documentary. I think it's the Vivaldi. But no, this is not a BBC documentary on honeybees. We're going to talk about some history, and actually, we're going to be doing a bit of prehistory today by talking about the American Revolution. Because you can't understand socialism in America, you can't understand the history of the American left without understanding bourgeois radicalism. And so we're going to be talking with Dr. James Vaughn, who is a postdoctoral fellow with the George Washington Forum at Ohio University. And James has been a very busy guy. He's just released two books, one on the French and Indian War and another on the British East India Company. So we're going to be asking him some questions about that. Though what I'd really like to do is pick James's brain about America as a British colonial project. Because James gives a revisionist account of this history, which essentially claims that imperialism wasn't initially about conquest and domination for British radicals like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine. Rather, he asserts that it was about advancing the project of human freedom in the form of a kind of global, cosmopolitan civil society. So we're going to talk to him about that, and in the course of it, we'll discuss the relationship between that and the native populations of the places Britain colonized, specifically Native Americans, and we'll discuss the English Revolution. And then we'll follow this with a second episode to be released in the coming weeks, where we cover the relationship between the American Revolution and slavery, as well as how to disentangle the legacy of the American Revolution from nationalism and other problematic forms of ideology and social practice in the 19th and 20th century. So, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy, and stay tuned for the release of the whole thing. So, the first thing I want to talk about is radicalism in the 18th century. Because I don't think this is an easy thing for most people to think about at all. Of course we have a whole history of socialism behind us, which becomes practically synonymous with radicalism at some point, probably in the late 19th or early 20th century. But we're not talking about that. In fact, we're not even talking about the birth of the left in the French Revolution. So let's say I'm a British subject living in colonial America in the 18th century, and I have radical politics. What does that mean, and why do so many of my peers feel the same way? Like, is this a function of the particular features of American society, or is it an inheritance of the English Revolution of the prior century, or what's going on here?
The premise of the question is correct, which is that revolutionary Whig currents are particularly strong in colonial America in the 18th century. And to put that in long-term perspective, in the early 17th century, when colonization and overseas expansion efforts in North America begin, that is English colonization and overseas expansion efforts begin, by and large, they receive only limited backing and support from the crown. Essentially, you have to remember the early 17th century, England is a middling to lower ranked power within the European state system, within the great European monarchies, and there isn't much in the way of infrastructure or resources that the crown can use to protect its power in Europe, much less across the Atlantic on in the Americas. And as such, what happens is English colonization and overseas expansion in North America is a very open zone. Undertaken largely by sub-state actors with limited state backing. It becomes a zone, an arena for the activity of commercial entrepreneurs, risk takers, those seeking social and economic mobility, religious exiles, political refugees, et cetera, et cetera. And because of that, essentially, there develops a kind of not quite straightforward political autonomy, but quasi-political autonomy in the colonies. They develop with limited backing from the crown. They often have aristocratic proprietors or merchant adventurers that are sponsoring them. But by and large, the colonists themselves are able to create their own political institutions and practices. And over time, they develop forms of self-government, colonial assemblies, colonial legislatures, such as the Virginia House of Burgesses, the Massachusetts Bay Assembly, etc. And essentially, that's more or less the case until the mid-17th century, when during the English Revolution, when the forces of Parliament defeat the crown, and following the deposition and execution of Charles II, a parliamentary republic is created. In that context, the revolutionary parliament attempts to assert its authority over Atlantic colonization and overseas expansion with trade navigation acts and a whole organization of the English Atlantic Empire. That faces a great deal of resistance in the colonies because essentially they've been used to an important degree of political and economic autonomy and self-development. Then when the English Revolution is essentially defeated, when the Stuarts are invited back at the Restoration in 1660 to take the crown and Charles II becomes the King of England, during what's known as the Restoration Age, roughly from 1660 to 1688, the crown attempts to assert greater control over the American colonies, largely in an authoritarian and autocratic direction, meaning trying to send out royal governors and to create an imperial executive that rules over the colonies with really little input from colonial elites or the colonial populations more generally. And that project, that kind of Stuart absolutist project in North America, comes to naught in 1688. In England in 1688, there's the Glorious Revolution, where the forces of William III topple King James II of England and lead to the creation of a constitutional monarchy and parliamentary government with the Revolutionary Settlement of 1688. And there are brother and sister rebellions in the American colonies against the Stuarts' autocratic royal governors in places such as Maryland and New York and Massachusetts. And basically, those royal autocratic governors are also deposed. So in the aftermath of 1688, in the late 17th and early 18th century, there's a kind of imperial conundrum. The metropole, the imperial center, London, wants to assert control over a colonial America because it wants to be able to draw the colonial, commercial, and maritime resources it needs to create a strong state, to further the development of England's society and economy, to increase prosperity and power. But on the other hand, the colonists have a very long tradition of self-government. And what happens in the post-revolutionary settlement, in what I would call the kind of post-1688, post-revolutionary imperial settlement, is a compromise is reached where effectively there is centralized metropolitan control asserted over the Atlantic Empire, over the American colonies, but not in an autocratic, authoritarian way. Rather, the colonial assemblies are allowed to raise taxes on themselves to an important degree, regulate and control their own economies and affairs in return for participating in a wider English and eventually after 1707 British Empire. So by the 18th century, the settlement that's taken place is that you have a constitutional monarchy and parliamentary regime in Great Britain that is in control of an Atlantic empire, including the American colonies. And that constitutional monarchy and parliament in London are responsible for managing the affairs of the empire as a whole, the maintenance of the Royal Navy to protect merchant shipping, to protect, to keep routes and sea lanes and market access open. And on the other hand, within that British Atlantic empire, the American colonies are allowed a wide degree of self-government and self-determination to basically control their own local affairs. Royal governors are sent over from London, but those royal governors have little in the way of money and resources on their own. Rather, they have to work with colonial councils and colonial assemblies. in order to get the taxes and revenues they need to build infrastructure, to develop harbors, to develop the Western frontier, to confront the French, the Spanish, Native American rivals, etc. And therefore, those royal governors have to ask the colonial assemblies and councils for those resources. And a process of negotiation opens up between the royal governors and the colonial assemblies. And over time, for several decades in the later 17th and 18th century, these colonial assemblies essentially transform into little parliaments. So you essentially have a British crown, which is the executive of the whole Atlantic Empire. And in Britain itself, that British crown is subject to the parliament and through it to British civil society. And in colonial America, on the eastern seaboard of North America, that British crown sends out royal governors to represent the crown, to be the local imperial executive. And they are, in effect, subject to colonial councils, the colonial assemblies, and through them to colonial civil society. And this is really the basis for the maritime and commercial empire of liberty that takes effect in the British Atlantic world, where the crown and its and the imperial executive is subject to assemblies, parliaments, and civil society, and essentially doesn't seek to rule over civil society, but rules through civil society, pursues infrastructure, pursues wars, pursues development, pursues taxes that are seen as furthering the self-development of civil society and Britain and its colonies on the eastern seaboard of America. And really, it's in that context where the eastern seaboard colonies of British North America develop with an important degree of self-government and a much wider commercial and maritime British Empire of Liberty, where government is broadly based on the consent of the governed, that the colonists develop these rich traditions of political debate and discussion, public sphere analysis and conflict, and a whole rich tradition which they understand broadly as rooted in the denouement, if you will, of England's Age of Revolution and the Glorious Revolution of 1688. And they come to understand themselves as essentially freeborn Britons on the western perimeter or the western frontier of this empire of liberty, but very much full participants in it. And what also needs to be added as an important socioeconomic factor is, of course, while English society, while bourgeois society develops in England out of a medieval feudal shell, in the American colonies, there is no medieval feudal shell. Once land has been colonized and Native Americans have either been displaced or their land expropriated, essentially there's implanted there quite modern bourgeois forms of government, of political rule and economic management, that means that the type of bourgeois society that's developing in England from a medieval feudal shell is also developing in colonial America without that medieval feudal shell. So by the mid-18th century, while colonial Americans conceive of themselves as freeborn Britons with their own little parliaments and their own little crowns, their royal governors that are subject to the law and local civil society and much part of a greater empire of liberty, fighting the kind of despotic and arbitrary empires of the world, they also really have nowhere near the degree of social deference, paternalism, consolidated oligarchy that exists in Britain because of the kind of differential social development where bourgeois society is emerging in Britain from medieval feudal shell, but essentially being implanted, if you will, along with plantation settlements in colonial America without any medieval feudal shell whatsoever. So there's a very strange way, I'll just conclude with this comment, in which the revolutionary traditions that are upheld across the British Atlantic world are even more fervently upheld in coastal British North America because of all of these developments that I'm putting together. They consider themselves freeborn Britons, and in many respects, they come by the mid to later 18th century in the period of the imperial crisis of the American Revolution to represent sort of the most commercial, the most radical, the most self-governing aspects of Britain itself. So you will see many British radicals, whether they're the famous Protestant nonconformists, the dissenter intellectuals such as Price and Priestley, or it's propagandists and pamphleteers such as Thomas Paine, or it's the radical Lord Mayor of London, William Beckford, they will look to the colonies as the horizon on which the sun is rising in the bourgeois future. They look to the colonies as a world free from what they see as feudal atavisms and aristocratic and arbitrary remainders and oligopoly and monarchy and monopoly. And so many, in many senses, colonial British North America comes for British radicals, real upholders of the British revolutionary tradition by the 1760s, 1770s, and 1780s. It comes to represent the new bourgeois dawn, the world of the future, if you will.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a question about this phrase, the Maritime Empire of Liberty, because I noticed that you use it in your book, The Politics of Empire.
Sure.
Okay, so I hope you'll forgive me for being a bit basic here, but I think this is worth unpacking. It's an empire, and so it's imperial or imperialistic, but it's an empire of what? Of liberty or freedom. And, you know, I've heard some strange stuff before. I've heard some words that don't make sense next to each other. But I'm struggling here. Because when I think of imperialism, I think of what it became in like the 19th and 20th centuries, which your book describes as the domination, division, and redivision of the world by the European great powers. But when it comes to the 18th century, you paint quite a different picture. In fact, you say that Enlightenment radicals hoped that imperialism would give way to a sort of cosmopolitan civil society, which would, and I quote, integrate and reorganize human activity on a world scale, and thus tap the potential for infinite wealth and boundless freedom that slumbered in the lap of social labor, unquote. So at what point does it become clear that the British fight against absolutism isn't simply about religiosity or advancing royal interests, but rather that it's about a form of society based on the primacy of parliament and the political economy of labor? Is there really a growing sense in this period that imperialism can actually be in the service of liberty?
So that's a great series of questions. And let me again sort of begin with a more long-term perspective, which is a series really of events and circumstances that come together around the year 1500. Essentially, feudalism has collapsed in Western Europe during the 14th and 15th centuries. And towards the end of that period, particularly in the later 15th century, you have the voyages of discovery and exploration, most famously in 1488, the Portuguese discovery of the direct maritime passage between Europe and Asia by rounding the southern tip of Africa. And of course, a few years later in 1492, Christopher Columbus's discovery of the Americas. And these developments basically come together, the collapse of feudalism, the development of free labor and the generalization of commodity exchange in Western Europe, and on the other hand, the series of exploration and discoveries and colonizations that take place, and they massively reinforce one another. Meaning, the more Western European adventurers and explorers have new discoveries, new maritime routes and passages, set up new colonies, the more the commercial and maritime dynamics they set in train reinforce the development of free labor and commercial society and free towns and cities in Western Europe. And on the other hand, the more free labor and commercial society and free towns and cities develop in Western Europe, the more this propels a search for new markets, new sea lanes, new trade routes, new colonies abroad. They become self-reinforcing. And eventually, throughout the course of the 1500s and the 1600s, the 16th and 17th century, they have transformed much of Western Europe. And where this transformation has gone particularly deeply is Northwestern Europe, places like the Netherlands, the Low Countries, places like sections of France, and also the southern British Isles in England, where feudal agriculture, feudalism has been completely wiped away. A generalized system of commercial agriculture has arose. Free towns and cities have developed on the basis of wage labor, and an entire civil society, a collective world of voluntary and a free association and exchange has come into being that has totally transformed the English landscape. Now, of course, there's an important connection between the English Revolution of the 17th century, the English Revolution of the mid-17th century, the 1640s and 50s, and the development, all those developments I've just been talking about with the rise of bourgeois society, the rise of civil society. And while there's a relationship, there's really only in the later 17th century, around the time of the Glorious Revolution, a developing full self-consciousness. There's really at the time of the English Revolution, the 1640s and 50s, the revolutions are not sort of informed by a self-aware, a self-avowed consciousness about the development of civil society, the development of commercial society, whereas you actually begin to see pamphleteers, propagandists, intellectuals talking about that at the time of the Glorious Revolution, most famously John Locke, of course, in his second treatise on government, which is basically a revolutionary manifesto written long before the Glorious Revolution, but then published in its wake to sort of explain to the English reading public what just happened. Why did we have this Glorious Revolution? What was it about? Where you get really the development of civil society becomes, if you will, self-conscious, self-aware in the wider English reading public. And as things develop in the decades ahead throughout the 18th century, particularly in the burgeoning towns and cities of Great Britain, in places like Liverpool and Bristol, even Manchester and Birmingham, 40, 50,000 people already at that point, above all in London, Edinburgh, Glasgow, there really is emerging in public sphere debate and discussion a real awareness of the way people's interactions and relations have been radically transformed by the development of the previous centuries. And a whole discourse develops around commercial society and civil society that really receives its apogee in famous thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment, such as Adam Ferguson, and particularly commercial society in famous thinkers such as Adam Smith and the Abbé Raynal. So over the course of the 18th century, it's really this new social freedom, this new collective freedom, this new interconnectedness that is greater than the sum of its parts, that is based on the dynamic interaction of free, voluntary, self-determining, self-possessed individuals that creates something socially that is more than the sum of its parts. This is becoming conscious in a whole Enlightenment discourse around commercial society and civil society. And so essentially that is becoming increasingly self-aware. And it's in this context that you get a whole series of pamphlets and newspaper articles and major books, the most famous of which are, of course, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations and the Abbé Raynal's A Philosophical and Political History of European Expansion in the East and West Indies, where essentially what is being told to the Western European reading public, including the British reading public, is you essentially are experiencing this new dynamic commercial society, not only because of transformations that have taken place within Europe, but also because of transformations that have taken place between Western Europe and its relationship to the rest of the world. And these two things have interacted to bring about your new state. And essentially, because if you go back to the quote you named from Marx, that what potential slumbers in the lap of social labor, there's a growing awareness that free voluntary interaction exchange, a free market and a free division of labor, is creating much, much more than the sum of its parts, is producing untold wealth never before seen. And so there becomes a view that the more people across the world that can participate in this freely and openly, the more there will be a greater open market and free division of labor in which more wealth will be created, more prosperity, and a virtuous cycle will ensue where prosperity lifts people out of scarcity and poverty and misery, allows them to pursue their interests, set the course of their own lives, and free interaction and exchange with others, and in turn creates an ever more expanding market and an ever more extending division of labor that in turn creates even more prosperity, bringing more people out. And so what's happened in Western Europe, the view is if this happens globally, this will be, if I can go back to the quote you gave from my own book, a possibility of reorganizing human activity on a world scale that basically taps the potential for infinite wealth and boundless freedom that slumbers in the lap of social labor. And really, what's becoming clear for a set of really radical and revolutionary thinkers in the mid-18th century. Now, they're not by any means the political establishment in Britain. They're often called the patriot oppositionists or the radical Whigs, who are very critical of the kind of conservative Whig establishment. Amongst those thinkers, there's a view that while, despite all of the kind of particular obstacles and problems that exist within the British political order and within the wider British imperial order, that nevertheless it is the best vehicle for advancing a kind of extension of the market, a global division of labor, and the potential for this increasing global free and voluntary interaction between peoples. And those radical Whigs and patriot oppositionists of the mid-18th century are the ones that really develop the full ideology of the Empire of Liberty, right? On some level, they recognize the fact that it is not in practical everyday life a empire of liberty, that there are a whole series of forms of enslavement, exploitation, misery, oppression that exist. But that nevertheless, there is also emerging along with those things, new potentials that really can be, if mobilized property can be a vehicle for this kind of radical goal of the integration of the whole globe in networks of free association and voluntary exchange that allow for an ever extending market and an ever expanding division of labor and creation of massive prosperity and progress, lifting people out of scarcity, misery, and the very exploitation and oppression that still exists within the British imperial order and elsewhere. And it's really those thinkers who by the mid-18th century understand the British Empire, although it's an imperfect vehicle, that it remains nevertheless the best vehicle, this Empire of Liberty, for the pursuit of that project. And that's why that despite all of their criticisms, that is within Britain, you have essentially a landed oligarchy of great aristocrats and gentlemen that rule and often rule in their own interests. And for all of their criticisms of the corruption and oppression and narrowness of that order, and for all of their problems with various institutions and practices that exist throughout the empire, they nevertheless think that there is more good coming out of that imperial order. And to coin a phrase that Bill Clinton used in one of his inaugural speeches in the 90s, that there is nothing that's wrong about the British Empire that can't be fixed by what's right with the British Empire. Again, I'm talking about in the era of the 1740s, 50s, and 60s, the era of the Seven Years' War, or really the Imperial Crisis and the American Revolution, where that radical revolutionary understanding goes into incredible crisis.
Right. And I'd like to talk to you about this crisis just a little bit, because this growing awareness that you're talking about of the expansion of human freedom as bound up with the proliferation of global commercial society. This coincides with the period of the High Enlightenment from roughly 1730 to 1780. And of course, the Seven Years' War, or the French and Indian War, whatever you want to call it, this happens right in the middle of that period, and it fundamentally conditions the American Revolution. So can you explain what it meant for the British or for British subjects to see the victories of the Seven Years' War as the culmination of the project began with the Glorious Revolution in 1688? And also, how did the outcome of the war register as a crisis through the radical politics that emerge in Britain in the 1760s?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So to take it back a bit again, emerging out of the Glorious Revolution of 1688, emerging in the post-revolutionary settlement is a domestic political order in Britain in which the crown is subject to parliament and the law, and thus is subject to rule through civil society. And likewise, in British North America, the royal governors, the imperial executive, is subject to colonial councils, colonial assemblies, and the rule of law, and is thus subject to colonial civil society. And so altogether, the imperial executive of Britain's Atlantic Empire is subject to the development of a kind of transatlantic civil society, if you will. And basically, the great opponent to this emerging, burgeoning British maritime and commercial empire of liberty is seen as Bourbon France. Why? Because coming out of the 17th century into the 18th century, Bourbon France, France is a kingdom of roughly 22 million people. It has a vast population, a vast territorial landmass. An autocratic political order has been consolidated. An absolute monarchy rules from Paris and Versailles with very little way of effective checks on its power and authority in the last instance. It's not really subject to assemblies and legislatures and the rule of law. And as such, its bureaucracy and its military can rule above civil society. Also, it is not only politically autocratic through an absolute monarchy, but it is religiously intolerant, persecutory. The Roman Catholic Church in France is strongly under the control of the Bourbon monarchy, and essentially the Bourbon monarchy and the Catholic Church enforce religious persecution. Now, there's some loosening of this in the 18th century, but by and large, France is still very much seen as a Catholic country and to be a subject of the Bourbon crown of France is very much to be understood to be a Roman Catholic. And so basically by the mid-18th century, by the 1740s and 1750s, amongst writers, intellectuals, propagandists, pamphleteers, amongst coffee house, public sphere discussion in the towns and cities of Western Europe in places like the Dutch Republic and in Britain and its Atlantic Empire overseas, in pockets of Spain and the Italian peninsula, pockets of France. Essentially, they're seen as a great contrast between a British political order based on constitutional parliamentary government, religious toleration, and the free expansion of civil society against a Bourbon French political order understood to be autocratic, religiously intolerant, and basically one in which the state rules like a behemoth over civil society, taxing it and drawing soldiers from it as it seems to be needed.
Right.
And basically these two political orders pursue a great power and imperial rivalry within Europe and beyond overseas throughout the later 17th and 18th century, starting with the Nine Years' War between 1608 and 1697, going on to the War of the Spanish Succession from 1702 to 1713, and then also the War of the Austrian Succession from roughly 1740 to 1748. And these wars are largely fought to a standstill, where this initially much weaker power, England / Great Britain, leads a coalition, a grand alliance of powers against Bourbon France and first Louis XIV, then Louis XV's pursuit of hegemony. And over time, it's very, very clear that Britain is emerging as a great power equal to and potentially even stronger than France. But yet they're both more or less relatively equal by the 1740s and 50s. So when the War of Austrian Succession comes to an end in 1748, And you must remember this, while for most European participants, the War of Austrian Succession is simply a European battle, not unlike the 30 Years' War that ended in 1648. For Britain and France, it's seen as a global battle.
Yeah, it has stakes on all four continents.
Exactly. The War of the Austrian Succession plays out in the Americas, in the Indian Ocean world and across African and Asian coastal theaters in the Mediterranean, in the Atlantic, etc. It's a global chessboard upon which the British Prime Minister and the French First Minister are moving their pawns, if you will, and pieces. And essentially, so when the War of Austrian Secession comes to an end, all sides are basically exhausted. The Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle is really a, if you will, a hot peace or a cold war. The sides are mutually exhausted. In fact, when it's signed, there's still conflagration and conflict taking place between French and British imperial agents in the Americas and in Asia. And it's seen as in no way conclusive. It's seen as no way ending this struggle, which is in one sense a great power struggle between Britain and France, but is very much another sense a struggle between a British parliamentary government and empire of liberty against a French absolute monarchy and authoritarian empire of conquest. And effectively, it's in the lead up to the Seven Years' War where people begin to think, particularly in Great Britain itself, many radical thinkers, Enlightenment thinkers, are beginning to think a kind of final conflagration, a great war for empires coming with Bourbon France that will be even more global and will decide a winner once and for all. However, the conservative Whig establishment, the kind of aristocrats and great gentlemen who run the country, who are the landed elites, who govern the country through an unreformed and unrepresentative parliament and their control of the crown and the patronage resources of the state, they are exhausted by the wars. They don't want to introduce the reforms and what we might call progressive transformations necessary to really tap maximum British resources and potential. And they do not want to really go back to war, even though it's becoming clear that war is more on the horizon and more necessary. And of course, by the early mid-1750s, despite the fact the conservative Whig establishment in Britain does not want to go to war, if its imperial agents are at war. The British and French East India Company are at war in the Asian and maritime world. And the British and French colonists are effectively at war in North America, along with their Native American allies, with the outbreak of what's known in the United States as the French and Indian War. And so finally, war has to come to Europe, and it does in 1756. And basically, during the early years of the war, very much, if I could call it the pre-war period, the pre-Seven Years' War period is the period in which the British and French are at war with each other, but it hasn't been formally declared in Europe. I'm talking here 1754, 1755, early 1756. And during the pre-war period, and even during the formally declared war years, 1756 and 1757, the French are winning. They're winning across the board. They win the Battle of Menorca. They're winning in North America. They're winning in South Asia. They're winning across the board. And the conservative Whig establishment looks exhausted. It faces a great deal of popular opposition because it's heavily taxed the population, and it hasn't used any of it effectively. It hasn't fought the war effectively. And the whole kind of British order is seen as exhausted and at its limits. And it's really in this moment where the leader of the Patriot Opposition and the Radical Whigs, a guy named William Pitt the Elder, because he's the father of the even more famous William Pitt the Younger, the conservative prime minister during the French Revolutionary Wars. William Pitt the Elder sort of is known as the Tribune of the People, and the conservative Whig establishment raises him effectively to office, makes him a kind of co-prime minister. He directs the Seven Years' War. And what he says to British subjects, both within the British Isles at home and abroad amongst the American colonists on the eastern seaboard of North America, what he says to those subjects is, you're going to have to raise a great deal of money. You're going to have to raise a great deal of troops. There's going to be incredible fiscal and military resources extracted out of you and expected of you. But this will be a kind of final conflagration in which Bourbon France will be defeated, and therefore all global obstacles to the expansion of Britain's maritime and commercial empire of liberty in the Americas, in Asia, in the Atlantic will be removed. And so despite all the fiscal and military costs that will be associated with the war, They will be more than recuperated by the kind of post-war world that will exist, in which the British Royal Navy will dominate the sea lanes of the world, dominate the oceanic routes of the world, in which the American colonists will be able to continue to settle and develop unfettered by the French and their Native American allies, in which British imperial activity in Asia will no longer face extermination at the hands of the French. And in this world of the British Royal Navy, instead of conquering people or extracting wealth from people, will simply guarantee the market routes and sea lanes of the world stay open, so that British manufacturing exports and commodities and colonists and settlers and immigrants can flow. And in this world, there'll be such commercial and manufacturing wealth created that it will more than recuperate the sums lost during the war years itself. And really attached to this, Pitt the Elder comes out of a whole movement, a kind of patriot opposition come radical Whig movement, that by the late 1750s, when he's come to power, that patriot oppositionist come radical Whig movement is really deeply rooted at the vanguard of civil society. It dominates newspaper cultures, extra parliamentary political cultures, public spheres, free associations and meetings in the towns and cities of the British Isles, above all in London itself. And it's really they who clamor, those extra parliamentary political cultures and public spheres of the towns and cities of the British Isles, that demand Pitt's inclusion of office and support his war effort. And Pitt comes out of that world, and he's very much open to the idea that in the post-reform, in the post-war world, creating a much more participatory and representative parliamentary political order for allowing new voices, principally adult males from the middling sort, to be included in the halls of power, to be included in a more representative, potentially reformed parliamentary political system. And so that's why by 1759, the year of miracles, when Britain has turned the tide and is winning everywhere, when the forces of the British Redcoats and the colonial American armies have overrun the French and their allies in North America, when the British East India Company, backed up by the British Royal Navy, has defeated the French East India Company and South Asian opponents such as the Nawab of Bengal, Siraj ad Daulah, and when the British allies, above all Prussia, Frederick II, Frederick the Great's Enlightenment Prussia, has defeated or has held at bay the great opposition of the Swedish, the Russians, the Austrians, or the French. It's in that year, by 1759, this year of miracles where the bells keep ringing for victory, that a lot of reformers and radicals, both in the British Isles, principally in the public spheres and extra parliamentary political cultures of the towns and cities, and on the eastern littoral, the seaboard of North America and the American colonies, radicals and reformers see this as a year in which a kind of vision, a new order of things becomes possible. And actually, what they think's happening, I said new order of things, but what they really believe is that potential for the empire of liberty that's existed for several decades is finally going to come to full fruition, is finally going to be realized in a reformed British political and imperial order that is even freer in terms of the expansion of the market, the extension of the division of labor, in global interconnections, and removing monopolies, oligopolies, oligarchies, and having more political inclusion and participation and representation.
Yeah, I've been told that they call both the annus memorabilis.
Mirabilis, that's right. That's the year of miracles in Latin, essentially.
Yeah, for both years, meaning it was used for 1688 and then revived again in 1759 as the completion of that project.
That's right, Matt. And let me just add one thing, and I'll be much more summary here. 1759 is a year of miracles, and you're exactly right. The Glorious Revolution was called the Year of Miracles, and 1759, in terms of British-French imperial rivalry, is called by the British the Year of Miracles. And that registers two things. It registers a successful defense of what has already been achieved since 1688, a constitutional parliamentary order within the British Isles and overseas in the American colonies, but it also represents the idea of the fruition, the fuller achievement, the greater radical realization of those orders, if that makes sense. It's a year of miracles because with victory over the French, the parliamentary political order, the constitutional order in Britain and in the wider British Atlantic Empire of Liberty has been successfully defended. But this now provides the opportunity for its even greater insertion, radicalization, expansion.
On a world historic stage.
Yes, exactly. The way this is registered, if I can give you two examples, there are people like William Beckford, who is a key ally of William Pitt the Elder. And in fact, when William Pitt the Elder is conducting the war, he's constantly talking to merchants in London about ways to cripple French maritime resources and commercial activity, but also the way they want the war directed so as to maximize market potentials, exchange potentials. And the person who's really organizing those conversations between William Pitt the Elder as co-prime minister and the merchants is this radical Whig politico in London named William Beckford. He becomes the Lord Mayor of London, and he's a West Indies planter. But he lives in London. He's essentially a rentier. And Beckford very much believes that the potential exists to reform the order at home, the British order at home, and to make it much more representative and inclusive. Essentially, Beckford believes that adult males of a middling sort background of commercial manufacturing wealth will be incorporated along with the land elite. And the reason why he wants to do that is not because he's obsessed with quantitatively expanding the suffrage, but because he thinks by doing that, the British state will become more responsive to the kind of civil society that's developed. In Beckford's imagination, Britain is a much more commercial and urban place than it was just a few decades ago. London is closing in on 1 million people, right? It doesn't have anywhere near the representation in Parliament it should. Manchester and Birmingham are already about 50,000 people, which is large for the mid-18th century, and they don't have any members of Parliament. Whereas a town like Old Sarum, because of the old medieval representation system, has 2 members of Parliament and 16 inhabitants. And so Beckford wants to make for Beckford, the British state has been subject to civil society, but civil society has freely changed, freely self-developed to become more urban and commercial. And so he wants that state order, which is dominated by aristocrats and gentlemen, by landed elite, to become more representative of the commercial and manufacturing middling sorts, because he wants the British state to remain more responsive to civil society than it otherwise is at that moment. He wants it to be even more responsive to the needs of the development of commercial society, of civil society, and those new commercial manufacturing and urban interests that have developed. And the other example I'll give you is very much a transatlantic figure, Benjamin Franklin, by this point equally a man of politics in London and a man of politics in Philadelphia. And Franklin very famously talks about how now, with this Year of Miracles of 1759 and its follow-up in 1760, that essentially there can be an unlimited free expansion of British colonial settlement, British trade, British maritime expansion throughout the world. And he says that the population of this Empire of Liberty will continue to develop, and probably its seat will eventually become North America. In other words, he's already anticipating something Smith points out in The Wealth of Nations, which, given the way things are going, given the fact that the British American colonies have boomed from roughly 200,000 people at the turn from the 17th to the 18th century to almost 2 million by the later 18th century, there's a sense in which the eventual seat of this Empire of Liberty will be North America. And of course, someone like Beckford and Franklin, they knew one another. They would probably, I'm speaking counterfactually here because I'm unaware of them. You know, I don't have any direct evidence of them discussing this. I have evidence of them discussing it separately. But if Beckford and Franklin got together and talked about that, they would have broadly agreed on that. They would have broadly agreed that this was going to happen and that eventually British North America would become the site, the headquarters of this global British Empire of Liberty. Now, of course, that did eventually happen, but it didn't happen in the way either of them expected.
Well, how does the defeat of the French and the opening up of the American frontier cast the American colonists' relationship to England in a new light? Meaning, how does it pose the question of the state, and how does it alter the position of Native Americans?
So that's a good question. With the conclusion of the Seven Years' War, with the signing of the Treaty of Paris in February 1763, the French more or less give up their claims to the interior west of North America. The British essentially take sovereignty over not only French Canada, Quebec, but the trans-Appalachian west. And with that, the question of colonial settlement is posed even more greatly than it was before, because now there are vast new opportunities for further colonial settlement westward. Just to give you a sense, remember what I said, around the beginning of the 18th century, around 1700, you have a colonial population in British North America that is roughly 200,000. Mm-hmm. And by the American Revolution, it's well on its way to being about 2 million. So you have a rapid, the social and economic expansion of British North America is really remarkable. There's really been nothing like it, that transformation. And you have to think, by the mid-18th century, the eastern littoral, the seaboard North America, has been well-developed. It has a well-settled agriculture, a successful farming. Towns and cities have emerged. And so people, new settlers, new adventurers, new immigrants want to keep pushing west. And of course, there's always the question of confronting Native American polities and rival imperiums, above all, Bourbon, France, and Spain. And with the Seven Years' War, you effectively have the removal of those obstacles, the laying low of these great Bourbon imperiums of France and Spain in North America, and the acquisition of, in European terms, direct sovereignty rule over Native American groups and polities in the interior West. And so in this moment, particularly, you know, British colonists, particularly the kind of most radical amongst them, the most committed to this whole vision I've been talking about as a kind of radical Whiggery, they view this as a massive act of potential social mobility, that they will be able to continue to move west. People will be able to acquire land. They'll become small farmers. They'll become successful. Eventually, they'll develop some commodity exchange. They'll accumulate some capital. They'll be able to expand into other things beyond farming. Their children will do better than they do. An immense, endless vistas, if you will, of social mobility have opened up. But of course, that poses the question of the relationships to Native Americans in a much, much more direct way, a much more direct way. And what also happens is, in the wake of the Seven Years' War and the signing of the Treaty of Paris, the conservative political establishment back in Britain has basically removed William Pitt the Elder from office. They've removed him from office, and they've essentially prevented the pursuit of any of his reforms, any of his kind of radical project, any further. And they do not want the further expansion or the radical expansion of colonial settlement in North America, because they do not want the to have massive costs of governing and garrisoning the Western interior. They want to keep the populations hugged to the Eastern seaboard, where they can assert control with a new standing army and more powerful royal governors over the colonial population, and they can therefore extract wealth, taxes, and revenue in order to pay for the immense debt and the immense costs of this vastly expanded post-war British Empire. And so there's basically three questions, there's three forces that come into conflict with the British victory in the Seven Years' War in the interior west of North America. There's the confrontation between colonial settlers and Native Americans, who essentially, colonial settlers want to move even faster to the west now, and the confrontation with already existing Native American settlements and polities. There's a relationship between those Native American polities and British metropolitan ministers and officials, because for really the first time, British metropolitan ministers and officials are directly ruling over thousands and thousands of Native American subjects with the Treaty of Paris. And the third sort of kind of force or what do you want to call it, a vector, is a, basically the confrontation between the colonists who want to expand westward and those that conservative political establishment in Britain that passes something called the Royal Proclamation of 1763 that says there can be no expansion beyond the Appalachian Mountains. There can be no further expansion, and they plan to create a system of garrisons along the western frontier that prevents further expansion. And essentially what happens, Matt, is in 1763, those metropolitan ministers and officials do the following. They pass the Royal Proclamation. They say no further expansion west of the Appalachians, which is a huge obstacle to the social mobility in colonial North America and therefore to the self-expansion of civil society, of bourgeois society. At the same time, they begin to want to create a string of a commercial entrepôts and military settlements, garrison and government, with an expanded peacetime standing army of 10,000 that will prevent further expansion and allow British authority to run in the colonies like it never has before, because there will be a permanent 10,000 man strong standing army there. And they also basically pick various Native American leaders and headmen to essentially become imperial bureaucrats, right? So I would pose a kind of counterfactual to you, which is that what would have happened, or what was beginning to happen, was many radical Whig thinkers in the colonies were beginning to think, and they will later think about, the confrontation between westward moving colonial settlers and Native Americans, and how can this confrontation be adjudicated, right? And of course, where the radical bourgeois imagination goes, where people like George Washington and eventually George Washington and Alexander Hamilton wind up, is the hope that Native Americans will simply be integrated into the expansion of American civil society, American bourgeois society as it moves west. And I think that question would have been posed much earlier, absent the Royal Proclamation of 1763 and the efforts of the conservative political establishment in Britain to prevent the further westward expansion of settlers. What they did instead was create a bureaucratic and military empire and then picked Native American headmen who essentially were sort of anointed, selected, appointed bureaucrats through which they would deal, right? Now,
Not unlike they did in India.
That's exactly right. That is a brilliant point, because that's what's happening. And the reason why you pointing that out so brilliantly captures what's going on a global scale is, having defeated Bourbon France, and I can't tell you how bad Bourbon France is by 1763. It's fiscally and military exhausted. There are peasant uprisings. They can't collect any more money. They can't keep the army together. They're totally weak. And so Britain has a global chessboard that lies before, in which they've checkmated Louis XV as much as anyone could have hoped for. And what that conservative political establishment does is, it doesn't want to reform at home. It doesn't want to include adult males of a middling sort background. It doesn't want to create more politically inclusive and representative institutions. And therefore, it becomes a limit to the expansion of civil society to bourgeois society in the British Isles. And also abroad, it looks at this vastly expanded empire where they rule thousands of thousands Quebecois Catholics and Native Americans they never ruled before, and they rule roughly 20 million Bengali, Muslim, and Hindu, for the most part, peasants in northeastern India. And instead of posing the question of how do these populations get integrated into a broader maritime and commercial empire of liberty that now includes them or begins to integrate them, what they begin to do is basically create what kind of 20th century Marxists would call imperial collaborators. In northeastern India, the British ruling elite and the East India Company collaborates with zemindari landholders and British generals. In this new standing army in colonial America, appoint Native American headmen. And the idea is you preserve traditional society on the eastern frontier and the western frontier of this British Empire of Liberty. Again, just to reiterate that, you preserve traditional society, or you seem to be rather preserving traditional society on the western frontier of the British Empire of Liberty in the Trans-Appalachian west of North America and on the eastern frontier of the British Empire of Liberty in northeastern India, and you bureaucratically integrate traditional rulers, zemindari landlords, Native American headmen that are really appointed to work with you to pursue the autocratic extractive goals you've already set in London. And at the same time, the same landed oligarchy in Britain does not reform at home. And so what's really happening, Matt, is what's being posed on a global scale with these alliances with zemindari landlords and with Native American headmen, and with wanting to prevent the further expansion of the British Empire of Liberty and prevent this question of how do British settlers and merchants interact with Native American and East Indian polities, right? Instead, what you have is a kind of reinforcement in a conservative reactionary fashion of traditional society. And if I can talk in very crude world historical terms, what the British political establishment is essentially saying is civil society, bourgeois society will expand no more than we wanted to or needed to do to reproduce ourselves, to reproduce the present as it is.